On this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
I always remember when my dad would say that to us, I would like look behind me, like, is he telling me I am? Because I don't feel like it. If you're unapologetic, everybody in Starbucks feels the safety that you provide inside that environment. If you can bridge trust between human beings, rebuild that trust that's been eroded over time, you just became the leader. Musicians who have to have stage gravitas. Guess what all of his training is based on? It's based on
health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
All right, you guys, this is it. My guest on today's show is a guy I hung out with for a few days with in LA while speaking at his event. And he's a pretty cool dude. You may have heard of him before because he was a guy who started his career in the NFL as top pick for the Houston Oilers. And then he played for the San Francisco 49ers and played with some of the greatest players in his generation as a defensive back and safety. And he's also a speaker. He's a performer. He's an author. His name is Bo Eason. In 2001, coming out of the NFL, he wrote and performed a one-man play called Runt of the Litter. One-man play, one of the most powerful plays in the last decade, the New York Times called it. So Bo toured with that in over 50 cities, and that's now being adopted as a major motion picture, that one-man play. And he's trained with some of the world's best and most brilliant performance and movement and voice coaches. And now what he does is he helps people tap into their own personal story and become really good communicators and really good movers and really good athletes and really good stage speakers. He's got a book called There's No Plan B for Your A Game. He teaches this stuff to people all over the world, both online and in in-person courses. And so I'll link to all of that and everything we talk about if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/Bo Eason. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/BOEASON.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. It contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and your yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com.
Well, Bo, I have to say that this is probably one of the stranger beverages that I've drank yet during a podcast. But I have to say, this harebrained idea of mine that I sprouted yesterday isn't half bad.
You know what? It's not. It actually gives the coffee some weight and some like a latte feel.
Some pluckiness.
Pluckiness.
We took vanilla stevia, which I always have around because it makes all my sparkling water taste like vanilla cream soda. But then I was at here at Bo's event, and it was a fabulous event that I'll explain to you momentarily. But one of the guys there at the event handed everybody this yellow packet of this stuff called Pluck, and it's like salt made out of organ meats.
Yeah,
right. It's like liver seasoning. And kidney and spleen and heart and pancreas, but it's a seasoning with some smoked paprika, lemon peel, black pepper, mustard seed, parsley, green onion, and thyme, which basically makes it sound like it tastes like ass, but it's actually pretty good. It's like this savory, really salty, yeah, it's called Plunk. There's a shout out to them. So it's in my coffee. So now my coffee is one big brown liquid multivitamin. It's pretty good. Bo, this was a cool event that you put on. You know, I came down and talked to some people about health, but you call it a best.
The best.
The best. What's best stand for?
It doesn't stand for anything.
Oh, I thought it stood for like Bo Easton something.
No. Oh. Somebody said that during the event.
They convinced me.
That's the first time I've ever heard that. It's just the way my dad woke me up. He woke all of us up. I'm the youngest of 6 kids, so my dad woke us up every morning at 5 a.m., because he's a farmer, a rancher, and so, you know, they get up early. So
like from how old were you when you started getting up at 5 a.m.?
Right from the get-go.
Oh, wow.
So that's how he woke us up. I could hear. So I'm the youngest, so I have sisters that are 11, 10, 9 years older than me.
Yeah.
And then me and my brother are the two youngest. I could hear him coming down the hall every morning. I knew he started in the older sister's rooms. And then eventually get to me and my brothers.
You could hear his footsteps coming down the hall at 5 a.m.
And you could hear him whispering, too. So he'd pull back the covers. He'd rub our back, like rough.
Yeah.
You know, not like gentle waking up.
Like, not like let's snuggle.
And he would whisper in our ears, and he would drop cuss words along the way. Because that's just how I don't know why all the men of that generation like ended every sentence with a cuss word, but he was one of them. And he would rub our backs and he'd whisper in our ears and tell us we were the best. And so
that's nice. So it's it was a rough back rubbing, but you're starting with the positive affirmation.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so for the first 18 years of my life, that's how I got woke up until I went off to college and moved out. But then when I came back, like when I was married and come back with kids, when we'd go visit my mom and dad, he would do the same thing.
Yeah.
He would say the same thing. He'd rub our backs the same way all those years later. So when I started waking my kids up, I just automatically started waking them up like that.
Yeah.
Same way. Because when we were kids, it was a source of embarrassment. Like me and my brother, growing up, he would say it in front of other parents. He would say it in front of our friends.
He would tell you you were the best
yes.
in front of other parents and other kids.
Yeah, but he also yeah. told them they were the best too. Okay. So it wasn't like he was trying to
kill. So he was just like, he's like, everybody be your own best.
Yeah.
That type of thing.
Yeah.
Not like my kids are better than all the other kids.
No, it wasn't okay. like that. He yeah. said it to
okay,
them
I get
too.
That.
He said yeah. it to my sister's friends, our yeah. friends. But we were always embarrassed, like at Little League, when he'd go, you know, he'd scream it like through yeah. the backstop, like, you're the yeah. best. And I'd be striking out going, I'm actually not, because I just struck out.
Yeah, and you train people at these events. I guess the best way I would describe it is to be the best version of themselves.
Yeah.
And you have people following all these positive affirmations and these, you call them declarations, as they each, you know, the guy here with the liver seasoning, he's growing that business.
Yep.
And another gal was in. You know, I sat in on a few of the sessions. You know, she's trying to be the best cybersecurity expert in the world. And
yep.
another gal, you know, a life coach who reaches a billion people. But for you, starting off with that mentality of the best that your dad would whisper in your ear when he'd wake you up with that rough back rub in the morning, did you actually grow up really, truly convinced that you were the best? Because I know you played in the NFL, and we can get a little bit here into how that progressed for you from childhood. But did you actually grow up thinking that you were going to be the best at whatever you tried?
At first, no. Even though I was being, you know, I was, he continued, he was really consistent all the way through. I remember, like, when me and my brother were, you know, we both had this dream of playing in the NFL. And we came from a high school that never had a pro athlete, a very small little high school.
Where'd you get that dream from? Was your dad into football?
My dad played football. He was in the military.
Okay.
I fought in Korea. He was, mostly just around animals his whole life, animal uh-huh. husbandry. But at first, I mean, I didn't really believe it at first. I thought he was talking to my brother. Because my brother and I were together because we were only a year apart. So we played sports together. Mm-hmm. We had this dream together. But in my eyes, my brother was much bigger, much better than me, and just still to this day, one of the greatest athletes I've ever seen. And growing up with that, I was small. I was much smaller,
yeah.
much, you know. And my job was just to try to keep up with him.
Right.
And I knew I'd be okay if I did that. So I just remember when my dad would say that to us, I would like look behind me like, who's he talking? Is he really talking to me? Is he telling me I am? Because mm-hmm. I don't feel like it.
Physically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then it was time for us to go to college, right? So for our dream to come true to play in the NFL, obviously you got to play college football. My brother and I both didn't get scholarships. And not only did we not get scholarships.
Were you good, though, in high school? Did you
yeah.
think you were going to get a scholarship based on how you were performing in high school?
I didn't know, but because it was much different back then. Like, they,
yeah.
they had to actually send a coach or a scout out to see you, and we were way yeah. out in the sticks, and we had a really good team. In fact, I always tell this story, but it's a statistical anomaly. It just can't happen, and it happened at my high school. So the high school I went to has never had a pro athlete of any kind before mm-hmm. I got there, and never won since I left.
Oh, wow.
So it's like 100 years
yeah.
of the high school's existence. But here's the cool thing. So me and my brother both had these dreams, and the statistics for high school football are there's 1.2 million high school football players in the country, and that's how many there were in 1978, 79 when we were in high school. So the statistics of those 1.2 million is 0.03%
okay.
of those 1.2 million, 0.03% will play NFL football.
Wow.
Right? So that's the statistics. So off my little high school team that's never had a pro athlete, we had 27 farm boys on that team, and we were good.
Yeah.
We thought we were good, and we were.
Yeah.
We were undefeated. Four guys out of those 27 played in the NFL for a total of 25 years. Two Super Bowls. There's no statistics for it. That's
there was something in the drinking water.
That's what everyone
cow's else, milk or whatever you guys were feeding on back then.
That's what everybody.
Wow.
Everybody always says, like, what was going on there?
Hmm.
What was happening? Why?
Interesting.
It's almost like one of those hotbeds of talent that Daniel mm-hmm. Coyle talks about.
Yeah,
where you get like most Olympic medals in swimming have come out of one pool in Northern
yep.
Maryland. You know.
Yeah.
In Baltimore. And then the greatest number one tennis players all come out of a little, women's tennis players come out of a little crummy tennis court in Russia.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah, I think like I personally, you know, as much as I embrace to a certain extent, like the woo and like the energy vortices that you find in Big Sur or Kauai or Sedona and areas where there's like less geopathic stress and all that jazz, I don't think it's that as much as you are the equivalent of who you hang out with. Yeah. And if you come from an area where even just during a brief period of time, you had four fantastic football players at that school, I'll bet you guys all pushed each other to be a little bit more next level than you would have pushed if you had been on your own.
Of course. I think it's because we had these dreams and they were public. Like we told people about it. I remember like laugh or we don't have athletes from this part of the world. You know,
right.
That just doesn't happen here. Because we stayed loyal to our dreams, I think other kids saw the possibilities, right?
Yeah.
They go, well, if Bo's going to do this, I certainly can do it.
Because
look at him. And the crazy part is, Ben, out of those 27 boys, four of us played in the NFL for all those years. There were four or five other guys on that team that were better than us.
No kidding.
If you can imagine that. Four or five guys better, bigger,
like
faster.
Subjectively to you or statistically, they were better?
Well, it was hard to keep the statistics because it was different positions.
Mm-hmm.
But in my eyes, in all of our eyes, we're like, damn, those guys can play.
Yeah. But you made it from high school to college.
Yep.
You weren't quite sure you were going to, though, to get into college football.
No one recruited, neither my brother or myself. Well,
what'd you do? Like, how'd you wind up getting into college football?
I went to a school called UC Davis, which is a Division II football at that time with no scholarship. So basically, you just walk on and you can play there.
Yeah.
And so I went there. And that was fairly close to where I grew up. Went there and then kept a dream alive there.
But your brother didn't?
My brother went to a junior college,
You
know, just like obviously no scholarships at a junior college in Sacramento. And after 2 years there, he then got a scholarship to the University of Illinois, which like within a season, he had broken every record and, you know, was a Heisman Trophy candidate, the number one pick in the New England Patriots. He's the first quarterback to take New England to a Super Bowl.
And what was his name?
Tony Eason. And then he was first round pick. I was a second round pick to the Houston Oilers in 1984.
But did you play the same position, high school through college into the NFL?
Yeah. I was a defensive back. I was a free safety in the NFL. In high school, I played both ways because we didn't have enough guys, right? So
I
played offense and defense. So the one thing that I tell people and I go, look, the whole 13 years toward chasing that dream, every day it seemed like it wasn't going to happen. Every day. And then every day a little glimmer would show you like maybe it is going to happen. And the rest of the day would be like, there's no way this is happening.
What size were you, like physically, height and weight?
Pretty small. So when I went to high school, so I was 13 or 14, I remember the weigh-ins, I was like 100 pounds and 5 feet tall. But I grew because now I'm 6'2". So I was a big free safety in the NFL in the 80s. I was 6'2", about 216, about the same weight you were in college.
Yep.
Now I'm like 180, 185. So
the same way I was when I was eating 6,000 calories a day and living in the gym.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what they did with me, you know, once I got to the college level. So I was pretty small, but I could run.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty fast. And I got faster as I got older. As I matured, I got really fast until I could really run.
You think that was one of your keys to success was your speed?
Heck yeah.
Yeah. Why do you think you were so fast?
Well, I worked on it a lot.
Yeah. How did you work on it?
Well, I ran a lot. I ran a lot of track.
Mm-hmm.
My form wasn't perfect, but I don't know how this miracle happened. One day my dad shows up. So my dad, you got to imagine this. So he's like a cowboy kind of guy. But he played football in college at Cal Poly.
Who can't walk softly at 5 a.m., we've already established.
That's right. And has rough, dirty hands. Yeah. And he brings home, and this is in the 70s. So this was before speed coaches were around. He brings this guy who's a speed coach to our little grass area where we would work out at the elementary school where we grew up. I grew up in a town with 725 people. So we had a little elementary school with a little patch of grass, and that's where me and my brother trained for the pros, right there. And we were about 14 and 15, right around there. So this was mid-70s, and my dad shows up with a speed coach. I don't know how the heck he even found him.
You have like a bag full of ladders and cones.
But he didn't have that stuff yet, but he was he was helping the – so the Russians were always beating the Americans in the sprints in the Olympics back in the 70s. He went over to Russia and was studying what they did. And that's –
like a spy.
Yeah, he was like a spy. Yeah. He brought those things back to America. And me and my brother were just lucky enough, and I don't know how it all transpired. I just remember him showing up at this little grass with us, with my dad, and teaching us plyometrics, which we'd never heard of.
Right.
Form running, like A skips, B skips, all the bounding, all that stuff.
Yeah. Way in the 70s, that would have been, you know, I mean, even for me, you know, because I've been reading the Journal of Strength Conditioning Research since I was in college, and that was in the late 90s. Like plyometrics and bounding and skipping and hopping were still like pretty cool and novel.
Yeah.
Like even in the, in like 2000, and that would have been like 2004, 2005. So yeah, in the 70s, that was definitely before its time.
Yeah. And that was, I don't know. That's what's so crazy. I wasn't, before my dad died, I wasn't able to let go. Where'd you get this dude?
Yeah.
Because I remember we'd be out there doing like, you imagine this in the 70s, you're on this grass and you're doing A skips and you're doing bounding, you're doing B skips. And the neighborhood kids would like come out and they would be cracking up.
Yeah.
Because it looked so foreign and so funny, like a dance move that we were trying to coordinate ourselves to do.
Right.
But I'm telling you, Ben, right when that happened, me and my brother took off like to another level of athleticism because we could outrun everybody on the court or on the field. Yeah. And once you have that advantage, then you start to put things together. You're like, okay, if I walk on any field for the rest of my life and I can outrun everybody on it, that's good for me. Mm-hmm. That's a big advantage. Yeah. And that's kind of how I made my bones.
I mean, obviously playing professional sport, I'm sure do an entire podcast on your career in the NFL. But you're obviously not only using your speed to your advantage, but your movement and your body awareness in general, I would imagine, especially with a career as a pro athlete, it not only is naturally high, but then develops and becomes even greater in that scenario. One thing that I've noticed about you when you're on stage and when you're speaking is you move in a very, very unique fashion, like almost like it's hard for people to take their eyes off you with the way that you move your body. Is that something that you developed in the NFL, or is that something that kind of became part of your speaking career afterwards? Just this whole movement while we're on the topic of, you know, what it is that got you success in the NFL.
Yeah, partly. I mean, partly due to, you know, the prowess that you have to have on an NFL field just to survive, right? So you get a sense of your own animal instincts. You get a real sense, and it's actually acknowledged instead of being frowned upon. You get a sense of your predatory nature out there, especially if you're a defender like I was, who have to defend the fastest men in the world and stop them. Like, that's your job, right? So you have to be very unapologetic physically, because if they smell, you know, these guys, they're predator animals basically out there, you know, especially back in the 80s. So if they sense weakness, you're going down, right? Uh-huh. So I learned part of it there, just purely a survival.
Moving with confidence.
Yes.
But you also like moving. I mean, did you have an actual animal that you would visualize and channel, or for you, was it just kind of like being a predator?
Not in the NFL. I didn't know to have an animal, right? But I literally, some of the guys I played against, like, you know, guys like Barry Sanders or Bo Jackson, Herschel Walker, Walter Payton, I give them animals. Like when I go up to tackle them, I'm like, damn, how am I going to get my arms around them? How am I going to get this dude to the ground? Because when you grab a dude like that, it's different than grabbing a regular man. You know what I mean? You put your arms around somebody like that and try to get him to the ground. It's a different animal. And I always thought, man, that, like, we had this one guy named Earl Campbell, who was one of the great running backs of all time. We played together. And then we traded him. I had to play against him. And he just would destroy defenders. And it would take 7-8 guys to get him on the ground. So basically, if you're the first guy in there, you're just hanging on to a shoelace if you can and wait for your teammates to get there. And it felt like not like a man. Like when you're grabbing somebody's leg or somebody's calf or somebody's haunches, it doesn't feel like
it's much more like springy, coily.
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah. And expansive. Yeah. Like it expands once you grab it.
Yeah.
So I remember
Super interesting.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like there is, you know, this idea that despite them being a similar size as humans, some primates like chimpanzees, for example, are disproportionately strong based on their body size.
Yep.
But it's because, you know, both the humans and the chimpanzees have this, like a Golgi tendon organ in the muscle belly that contracts at a certain point to keep the muscle from tearing itself. Mm. Like it's kind of like the governor of the muscle.
Wow.
And when you see like a mother like lift a burning car off of, you know, her baby that's trapped underneath, you see basically what would be an example of a complete disinhibition of that Golgi tendon reflex.
Yeah.
And it turns out that some people actually have basically like a higher governor point at which that Golgi tendon organ kicks in and says, oh, we gotta hold this muscle back now because it's contracting too hard. It's going to rip the tendon off the bone, you know, or something of that nature.
Yeah.
And so I would imagine there might be a little bit of a component where like their springiness is so enhanced, not only due to plyometrics and speed training and, you know, maybe a higher fast twitch muscle fiber capacity or whatever, but also due to the fact that their brains just aren't shutting down those muscles quite as quickly.
Yeah. So it's like it's something you don't, I never experienced in high school. I never experienced in college. But once you got to the best of the best, running backs especially, they're just built that way. Low to the ground, thick, and just glutes, power.
Yeah.
And when you put, I'd never forget this experience. Normally when you get your arms around another man, your arms are locked in and you got him. And
right.
You just get him to the ground. Well, I just remember this experience, grabbing these kind of players like Earl mm-hmm. Campbell around like that, and then their body expanding mm-hmm. right when I grabbed him. And then my hands came apart. Right? Like, so my,
it's crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
And I go, that's actually, I've never felt that before. It's like an animal.
Yeah.
Remember how Popeye would eat the spinach and then he would expand?
Yeah.
Like the cartoon?
Yeah.
Well, that's what these guys.
I wonder
guys,
how much of it was just like diaphragmatic rib cage, like air expansion, you know, from them just, you know, right as you hit them, or whether they actually, you know, if you watch a bodybuilder on stage, for example, like when they contract, the muscle just keeps contracting and contracting. And it just balloons in size.
Yeah.
But maybe something like that, but done just over a split second, just boom.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. So I had that sense, but I wasn't really trained at it. It was mostly a survival mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Then after I got done playing and I got into writing, you know, I wrote a play and it, you know, became a hit and it went to New York for, and all over the country for several years. That's where I learned to move on stage because the guy who directed my play, Run to the Litter, when we went to New York, he said to me, and he didn't know anything about football or athletics. He was a great acting teacher and a great performance coach, right?
Right.
And he said, okay, Bo, here's what we're going to do before we go to New York. We are going to hire a movement coach. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm an elite athlete, dude. I don't mm-hmm. need a movement coach. I never even heard of a movement
right.
coach.
Right.
Sure enough, brings in the guy named Jean-Louis Rodrigue. That's his name. And
Jean-Louis Rodrigue.
He is a professor at UCLA. He is the master of movement.
Oh, wow.
And all of his movement. So he not only does he coach me and the people that I work with who need mm-hmm. stage presence, he works with Leonardo DiCaprio. He works with Tobey Maguire. He works with Margot Robbie, like the best actors on the planet. He works with musicians who have to have stage gravitas
uh-huh.
and weight.
Wow.
Guess what all of his training is based on? It's based on predator animals.
Wow.
Crazy, right?
What are the chances? And you were already kind of pre-programmed for that in the NFL.
That's exactly right.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. Put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their sexual performance booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a re-hit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com.
They explained to me that, look, moving on stage is a little bit different than moving on the field, right? Because you're going to have to do this performance over and over and over again, in which I did do the performance 1,300 times over.
The Broadway performance that you wrote after getting out of the NFL.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he came on board. We started picking animals, like you asked me earlier. Mm-hmm. And so we picked for that performance, particularly, it was a cheetah.
Because and so you had to pick from a predatory animal.
Yes.
What would be another example of a predatory animal or some of the others, like a panther or a lion?
Panther, a lion, a great white, orca.
It'd be hard to move like an orca.
Right. But it's not. Here's the cool part, Ben. It's not that you have to move like an orca, but you take on their sensibilities on stage. Mm. The audience doesn't. Here's the great part. Audience does not know what you're doing. All they know is they're not looking away. That's the
They can't keep their eyes off you. They don't know why, but they can't keep their eyes off you.
That's the promise of this kind of work. I would dare anybody to be in a live audience or even virtually with a predator that can eat you and you look away. As human beings, we're locked in on them. Like if I put a lion on a stage in front of you live, you're not walking around. You're not casual. You're not looking at your phone. You're not throwing peanuts at the lion to mess with it. You're locked in for survival purposes on a predator that has brought danger to the room and a sense of nobility and trustworthiness. That's what how I was taught to be on stage. Because these two guys that I trained with, Jean-Louis being one, Larry Moss being the other, the one thing I noticed about all the performers that they worked with is they won Academy Awards or they won musical awards. Or you, something about them, you couldn't look away from them. So here's what happens. I'm performing like this predator on stage. And it, as it turns out,
moving like a, you said a cat, a cheetah.
A cheetah. So very sleek, very fast, but a real sense of vulnerability.
Tell me you didn't have the leotards on though.
No leotards.
Okay. No cheetah print leotards.
And no, it's funny because no one knows because they can't see that you're being a predator cat. They just don't understand why they're not leaving or standing up and walking out or going to the bathroom mm-hmm. or calling their spouse mm-hmm. during a performance.
Right.
So that's why we did it. So as it turns out, Ben, and I think your audience would be really interested to know this. It's so cool about Jean-Louis. So Jean-Louis is this, you know, just regular dude who trains people how to be unapologetic about their predatory nature, which gives mm-hmm. them a sense of gravitas and power. What happens is the FBI comes calling. So the FBI one day calls Jean-Louis, and they're like, this is the FBI. And Jean-Louis's like, oh, shit, what did I do? Was I on the wrong website? You know, he's like
yeah.
panicking like you and I would do
right.
if they called us. What was happening at the FBI, and Jean-Louis can't tell me everything, but he can tell me some things. What was happening at the FBI was over in the Middle East, our FBI agents who were infiltrating those cells, mm-hmm. who were Middle Eastern descent guys themselves, but they were Americans. Mm-hmm. infiltrating the cells. What was happening, they were being killed at these high rates because their bodies were betraying them. They would spend years training these guys, years trying to get them on the inside of the cell close to the leader. Once they got close to the leader would embrace them.
Right.
And then step away and kill them. And it wasn't anything they were doing. It wasn't anything they were saying that was wrong. They were playing the part right.
Mm-hmm.
Their heart was pounding.
Oh, that's when he hugged him, he could feel the heart.
He could feel it. And, you know, obviously, if you're infiltrating a cell, those cell leaders are, you know, they're predatory animals, just
yeah.
like the NFL, just like what I've been taught to be on stage. So they started training with Jean-Louis, the top 15 agents. Imagine this, in Hollywood, in a little theater. They rent a little theater, got 15 of the top agents. He can't say what they look like. He can't say anything about them. He's training them to not allow their body to betray them. So now think about that. So,
or even their physiology.
Right.
So he's training them to even control their heart.
Yeah. So think about that. Now, say you're a speaker, say you're a writer and you have to do speeches or anybody who presents, mm-hmm. which is all of us, right? And you have this in your pocket. The same training the FBI agents have because they got to be a lot better performers than you and me. But Jean-Louis doesn't see it.
Might
like
not
that.
Have access to beta blockers to lower their heart rate.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
I mean, he said they're the best performers I've ever seen because
wow.
they have to be.
Wow.
Because if you're off there, you're dead.
Right.
But isn't that true for you and me too, if you think about it? Like if you and
if
me...
If you look at it from Maslow's hierarchy of needs standpoint, yeah, I mean, yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, but subconsciously, I really don't think that our lizard brain is able to recognize a giant audience that we are super fearful of, that we associate with a negative outcome should things go wrong, and an actual, whatever, you know, army attacking us or a lion about to eat us. I think that sometimes we can spin our subconscious into the same state.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there is a certain, I suppose, you know, fear of death when you're on stage.
Yeah.
I mean, and people, that is literal.
Well, I've often felt like that, like, oh, shoot, if I fail right now, with the mm-hmm. New York critics in the house,
right?
I'm done.
Right?
They're going to send me home.
Right?
And it felt like death. So then after the success that the FBI started to have,
mm-hmm.
Working with Jean-Louis, the CIA came along and wanted the same training. So the bottom line is, I always take comfort in that I've worked with the guy who the agents of our country to keep us safe are using also.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why at all my events, and when I bring up physicality as a part of my training, people are like, well, what do you mean physicality? I don't have to be physical. I just have to move my mouth. I just have to talk. You know, you find out that talking, you know, doesn't move the dial.
Yeah.
Right? The mouth doesn't really move the dial. Your body does, your physicality. Right. And
anybody who has watched someone give a speech from behind a lectern
yep.
with a bunch of slides that he's pointing a laser pointer at knows the difference between that and that person, you know, who's, you know, I guess you could use an analogy in the realm of like, you know, like Christian pastors that you see, right? There's like kind of the stereotypical guy with the neat suit and tie standing behind the oak lectern, you know, giving a message, you know, with a PowerPoint behind him. And then there's a guy like, you know, Joel Osteen, just like all over the stage and, you know, and moving and waving the hands and, you know, in a manner that definitely dictates that he's much harder to ignore.
Yep. And you know, in the times that we live in now where the trust level is so low, you know, because Gallup's done a poll ever since 1974 every year on the trust level in America, and it's never been lower, right? It's at its all-time low. So to restore that trust, that's going to be leaders, right? That's kind of the position that I know that I'm trying to play, and I'm sure you are too. To get that trust, you have to show people your body. They have to be able to see your body because people believe 50...
Even your hands too, right? Hands. That's what I've heard is that you must show your hands if you want to be trusted.
Yep. 100%.
Yeah, people don't want to think that they might be, you know, subconsciously think that they might be hiding a weapon or hiding something away from them. Showing the hands is a sign of trust.
That's right.
And you can trust me.
Yeah, so the people believe about 50% of what comes out of your mouth, and that's just across the board, right? Mm-hmm. You might be telling the truth the whole way, and 50% of it's not being believed, not being trusted. Mm-hmm. But your body is trusted. 100% of the time, because that body can't lie. A few years ago, like ESPN started putting poker. You ever seen this? Like they put poker on...
Yeah, Texas Hold'em.
Yeah, yeah. Like on sports. And I'm like, why is this?
Well, ESPN too, but yeah, it's on ESPN. Yeah.
But I always thought, like, because I'm not a card player, but I'm like, why? And it's all because of the body. Everyone's watching for a tell, watching for a reveal, watching, am I trusting this guy or not? Mm-hmm. Same thing we do with politicians, which is why they stand behind podiums, because just imagine what's happening behind that podium. Mm-hmm. Their body is betraying them.
Yeah.
So if those politicians were trying to infiltrate a cell, they would not make it, not very long. Mm-hmm. But that's why they stand behind those lecterns that you just mentioned. My mouth is trying to tell you the truth, you know, of what I want you to believe. But behind this lectern, you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can't look at somebody's legs or the way their feet are sitting or their hands, like you said, I don't trust them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all my notes are on the lectern too. But yet I've noticed that the guys who do a good job moving around stage, sometimes for a massive 40-minute, you know, sermon or something like that, there's a lectern up there.
Yeah.
And every once in a while they pass by it to take a glance at the notes.
Yeah. That's what I do if there's a lectern up there. I just use it as a prop.
Yeah. You're right though. The body doesn't lie. It's one of our favorite games right now to play as a family. Like I think I was telling you in the car the other day, you know, it's the best $25 I spend every month is to go buy a family game.
Yeah.
Because it just provides our family with, you know, hours upon hours of new entertainment each month and bonding and laughing and relationship building. And the kids are learning game theory and logic.
And how to compete.
And how to win. Yeah. And the fact that in most games, there's one winner, not everybody gets a medal, which is typically the person who gets to whatever, pick dessert or not have to clean the kitchen or, you know, winner, it pays to win.
Yeah.
So anyways, there's this game called Chameleon that we play, and Chameleon, I won't describe the entire game, but suffice it to say, a great deal of it involves trying to hide from someone that you are the chameleon, and everyone else on the table is trying to identify who the chameleon is, almost like that old game Mafia, but in a kind of a cooler, more fun way with these special cards. And it is crazy how quickly my kids began to pick up on things. Like, you know, when I'm the chameleon, I just subconsciously put my hand on top of my card as I'm talking to people, almost as though I don't want people to know that I have the chameleon card, whereas they notice the people who aren't the chameleon, they really don't even care where their card's at. It's just like sitting there, whatever.
You don't have to protect it.
The card's nothing to me. I don't have to protect it. Yeah, or you know, things like the amount of eye contact that people make with their card. So now when the cards get dealt, they're all watching everybody's eyes just to see, you know, are they looking at the card and putting it down quickly, which sometimes indicates they're the chameleon. So yeah, it's relevant too, I think, for people, Bo, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, who are listening in to us talk and thinking, well, I'm not a speaker. I don't have to be on stage. I'm not giving presentations. I'm not giving a sermon, whatever. But in any situation in life, the way that you enter into a room and the way that you move about a room is pretty important, isn't it?
Very. 100% critical. Even when you just walk into Starbucks and there's a long line at Starbucks and you walk in, all of a sudden, if you're unapologetic, if you're actually your own predatory nature, everybody in Starbucks feels the safety that you provide inside that environment. So think about every environment you enter, whether it's, you know, a church, whether it's at school, whether it's at a stage, whether it's at your business. When you're unapologetic, people feel safe. It's counterintuitive, right? Because you mm-hmm. think you'd be afraid of predatory nature, but you're not. You actually feel mm-hmm. safe around it. No different than a mama grizzly bear. You know, mm-hmm. you step in between her and her cub, right? That's a problem for you. You're pretty mm-hmm. much done. And when you're in the presence of a mama bear, like my wife's like that, right? Mm-hmm. My mom was like this as far as protecting her kids' dreams and her kids' health. We, as human beings, love that feeling of being protected. Mm-hmm. I work with a lot of elite military, whether it's Navy SEALs or Green Berets. And when I'm around them, I never have felt safer. They're the most dangerous people, right?
Right.
Same with NFL players. The most dangerous NFL players that I ever played with, right? Like vicious on the field, dangerous. You feel so good in their presence because you know you're taken care of.
Yeah, that's the funny thing is that if you think about it, let's say you're on a subway train with someone who actually is moving like a predator, you know, obviously it can, you know, carries with them a great deal of confidence and pride and, you know, almost like a don't mess with me type of mentality, and you can't keep your eyes off of them. You kind of subconsciously know that should somebody like who's actually dangerous or a threat to you walk on, that person might be your protector, right? Yeah. That everything's going to be okay, or that you're not going to have to fight because there's somebody else on this freaking train who's probably going to fight before you do.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So that I think our world is, we're so ashamed of that part of ourselves, mm-hmm. our human nature. We're so ashamed of it that you and me are walking around trying to hide that, mm-hmm. that great aspect of this protective nature. But I tell the people that I work, as far as stage work, as far as being the boss, as far you're the leader everywhere you go. And that goes for everybody. Your responsibility is to lead every environment you enter. So you can't enter that room like half-baked. You can't enter that room like a prey animal.
Right.
You can't. Otherwise, everyone feels it. And everyone goes, you know, I don't feel good in this room. I don't feel safe. And that's how our world feels right now. So we need more of these leaders. So you have to be unapologetic about your true nature.
And for you, it comes down to everything from planting your toe before your heel as you're taking a step, or I've noticed you'll like kind of like lace your hand over the back of a chair as mm-hmm. you're walking through a room and be kind of like feeling out the room. You're kind of like standing, you know, 2 inches taller,
yep.
and you know, making very good but deep eye contact. Are these things that you teach in your book, or are these things that are primarily taught like in your courses?
Yeah, we touch upon it in the book. The book mm-hmm. is more about being the best. We talk about storytelling a little bit in there, mm-hmm. but it's mostly in the speaking training that I do.
Yeah.
Personal story, yeah. power.
And you train people how to use their voice. I know a big part of it's storytelling for you, how to tell their story.
Yep.
Is that something that you kind of learned along the way, the importance of story?
Yeah. You know, if you go, again, I always go back to Mother Nature, right? So if we can align ourselves with Mother Nature, we're pretty much going to be undefeated. Mm-hmm. You know, every time I go up against her, I usually lose. Every time I have an argument with her,
right.
I lose.
Right.
When I fly with her, I usually win,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's how the training goes, right? So most people in this modern society that we live in, they do presentations. Like you said earlier, they're trying to manipulate the audience and not be human, mm-hmm. not make mistakes, be polished, be perfect, use slides.
Yeah.
Well, there's no connective tissue there. There's no human connective tissue on a slideshow. There's no connective tissue when you're staying distant from your audience and trying to manipulate them, whether with your voice or your body. It's not that we don't train that way. We train to be human. And the human is the one that connects with other humans, that vulnerability you have. And when you share your story, everyone starts to connect to you because they go, oh, I didn't really know how to connect to Ben. And then he told me his story. He told me this quick story about what his grandfather may have told him sitting in front of the fireplace.
Right. It doesn't have to be like your life story. It could be a story.
It's a tiny little 2-minute story.
Yeah.
And right when that happens, the audience drops their guard. Every audience right now, whether it's virtual, whether it's in person, whether it's at Starbucks, everybody's got their armor up.
Right.
We're protecting ourselves.
The audience slash someone who might be on a date with you slash someone who you might be networking with at a cocktail party, like, you know, even if it's not from stage, once you start telling a story about yourself, that turns you into an authentic, potentially more trustworthy human.
That's right. That's the only way people know how to connect to you. They don't know how to connect to you if you're distant, if you're not going to share.
And especially if you've nailed the predator moves, like people are probably going to kind of keep their distance until that predator actually starts telling stories and people realize that the predator is human.
Yep. And the predator is me. Like that's the connection they've get. Here's the beauty of storytelling. It because people sometimes I'll be training people and they'll go, well, Bo, I don't want to tell my personal story because it's not about me. It's about my clients or it's about my audience. And I'm like, yeah, but the only way to get the trust from your audience or your client or would-be client, the only way to get the trust is to share who you are. Your perspective of how you grew up. Like when you could say a sentence like this, is one of my stories. When I was 9 years old, I had this dream. So I drew up this 20-year plan. So if I say that's one.
When you're 9 years old, you drew up a 20-year plan to be in the NFL.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I can show it to you.
You still have it?
Yeah. Yeah. I have it. Right.
And you followed the plan.
Where is it? It's in my backpack.
It's just like hanging around your house.
Wow. So, crazy. But I just said a sentence. And you said you stopped everything we were doing. You stopped the podcast, not stop it. You know, you just stopped where we were and you went, you asked me a question about it. Because now that's storytelling. So that's one sentence of storytelling that was personal to me. And now it's personal to you. So now you and me, here's the magic of storytelling. Now you and me have a connection that we didn't have before. Like you're thinking back, shoot, because he just said he was 9 and he said 20 or what was I dreaming of at 9?
That was actually what I was thinking.
Right.
About.
Yeah. And did I make up a plan? And I could have. Yeah. I didn't think that's.
Yeah.
So now you and me are real dudes, not trying to fake connection, actually just sharing a dream, a thought, a pain point, and you get connection. And that is the key to the kingdom when it comes to storytelling.
Yeah.
And most people, they're so afraid to share themselves. They're so afraid to share the pain that they've been through. Like whether they got dumped at the prom, or they got cut from the choir team, or they got cut from some athletic team. It's all this rejection part people don't want to share because they'll go, well, no one will want to work with me if I'm rejected. Actually, the opposite is true. Everybody will work with you because guess what? They've been rejected too. Everybody knows the pain you're talking about. So if I said my dream was to be the best pop singer in the world and my mom, I was singing in the back of the car one day. My mom turns around when she was driving. She said, you know what, Bo? You're the worst singer I've ever heard in my life. That is a great story. That's a great story because everyone connects to that.
Yeah.
That dream that somebody destroyed right there.
Yeah.
And then what did you become? And that's why we use story, because in a world that will not connect, we will. Now you're the leader. If you can bridge trust between human beings, rebuild that trust that's been eroded over time, especially now, you just became the leader.
And people, I think, have story almost woven into their DNA.
Yeah.
I talked about this in my last book, Fit Soul, about how when you see a lot of the very successful Disney movies like Frozen and The Lion King and Snow White and Sleeping Beauty and beyond, they all follow the classic hero's journey story, as does Star Wars, as does The Matrix, as does nearly every successful Hollywood flick that exists, and many of the most successful novels, right? Including even just like the story of Jesus Christ, like the whole gospel tale of how the world was saved. Like all of it returns to someone in an ordinary world, crossing a threshold, having mentors and allies along the way, finding the enemy, fighting the enemy, sometimes nearly dying, returning home with the elixir. And, you know, I think that humans crave not only story, but they crave that story to a certain extent. Yep. How much do you emphasize having as part of your story being that hero's journey, including elements of it?
All great stories are the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. It's funny how it fall. All those archetypical things that you just talked about, like mm-hmm. like the mentor and the you know, and the elixir and all that, that falls into almost every story.
Yeah, well, it does. And it even sounds silly because, like, last night I was talking about my wife and I made the bicycling trip to Italy.
Yeah.
Right? We left our ordinary world of poor college students in Washington, crossed the threshold across the sea, you know, battled the hills to, you know, find the gelato and the, and the bread and the pastrami, and eventually, you know, returned with the elixir and got to Florence. And, you know, and then the road home, you know, like the end of Bilbo Baggins, you know, the train back to Rome and fly home. But yeah, if I tell a story like that, even subconsciously, I'm telling the hero's journey story without even realizing it.
And here's the science behind it. People can't, that's intoxicating, right? Mm-hmm. That means you're bonded forever with those people, not just for the moment, forever. Hero's journey is the hero's journey.
The hero's journey, people also relate with it and feel comfortable around it because it is a tale of non-morally relativistic absolute truth. Mm-hmm. Because in a hero's journey, there's always got to be good and evil, right? There's always got to be the light side and the dark side. There's always got to be the winner and the loser, the bad guy and the good guy. And I think people like the fact that there's like some truth, you know, like some shreds of absolute truth in that tale as well.
100% there is. You know, the play that I wrote, it's called Run to the Litter, that was this big hit, right? So it got all these movie companies started to come to me and my wife and say, hey, we want this for a movie. This one guy approaches me and he comes up and he goes, I want this to be my next movie. And I go, okay, but who are you? And he goes, my name's Frank Darabont. And for those of you who don't know, Frank Darabont is the writer and director of The Shawshank Redemption, of The Green Mile. He wrote Collateral. He wrote Saving Private Ryan. He created the series The Walking Dead. Hmm. So he's the, you know, at this time, he's the top Hollywood writer.
That's crazy. I'm not big into Hollywood, but I've actually seen all four of those movies.
Yeah.
And competed in reality TV show filmed down at the Walking Dead location.
Is that
in
right?
Atlanta. So I've also been there. Anyways, though, we digress.
So he's the one. So Castle Rock Pictures bought the screenplay rights to for him, right, to direct. And I wrote the screenplay.
Wow.
So now I'm writing a screenplay of which I've never written a screenplay before. So I don't know the format. I don't know how it's supposed to go. All I've written is a play, one play, a one-man play. So it's just me. So now I got him now mentoring me. So now he's the top screenwriter in the world. Now he's like looking over my shoulder going, move this, you're misspelling that.
Wow.
So that was my first touch of screenplay writing. So I got trained on exactly the stuff you're talking about, which is, you know, this hero's journey, Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. Because if you're 1 minute off on certain things in a movie, like if that turning point comes at minute 29 or minute 31, you have problems with your audience. Mm-hmm. Your audience is now looking at their watch. Your audience now is like thinking about if they should go get some popcorn in the theater. And now you've lost.
Huh.
If that turning point doesn't come on page 30, which is 30 minutes into the movie, and then this, there's a second one, and then there's the end, it's like a map. It's like science storytelling as far as screenplays are concerned, for sure.
There's even a book, Christopher Vogel wrote the book, The Writer's Journey, which is actually a great one for story.
It's the best
writing.
That's the one. Yeah. Frank Darabont, I can't believe you just brought that book up. He goes, Bo, you're going to write this screenplay for me. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like so nervous because he just got like nominated for 12 Academy Awards.
Yeah.
And he handed me that book.
Oh, really?
He goes, this is your Bible. It
That's
was
funny.
Big green book.
It was one of the first books I had my kids read when they started writing. I'm like, you guys read that? They were like seven and they read The Writer's Journey just because I wanted at that early an age for them to begin to see story through that lens.
So smart. No wonder you have such a connection to Frank Darabont. I mean, not you didn't know it,
right?
But you do.
Subconsciously, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I keep using the word subconsciously on this podcast. Subconsciously. Well, you know, there's so many other things that I could get into with you, but sometimes I do follow my gut and my heart when I'm recording with someone. And I think the one other thing I think would be interesting for your audience to hear, I don't know if you have or have not talked about this on podcasts before, but you obviously are a family man. You love your family. You got wonderful children, and I see how you're raising them and how much you pour yourself into them. You know, I noticed that they both seem to have some pretty definite goals in life. How is it that you have either seen your children respond to the type of lessons that you have learned? What have you implemented with them that you think has allowed them to, I mean, because your son, he's what, 14 and already knows he wants to compete in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And your daughter's got like a cooking show or a video series she's producing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's 16. She wants to be a great chef.
Yeah. What's the special sauce for your kids?
You know what I did from the word go is I kind of did what my dad did, kind of followed the same, because he was more, he was quieter than me, my dad, but he saw greatness in people. Like he saw it and then he spoke to it. Mm-hmm. And then it gave you all kinds of space to kind of figure it out for yourself. All the time he did that. So I did that with him initially. And the one daughter you haven't met. So I have two daughters and Axel's in the middle. So they all immediately showed them, you know, when they were fairly young, the 20-year plan. And my 20-year plan is like very...
You showed them your 20-year plan that you made when you were 9.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it looks like, at this point, it's 50 years old. So it looks like the Declaration of Independence.
It's like parchment paper.
It's like that brown...
A quill pen.
Yeah. Quill pen. And it's very like regular. It's me, you know, in a football uniform, like as a 9-year-old might draw that, with cleats that are about 14 feet long. I mean, it's just crazy. And me and my brother, that's kind of how we started our dreams. We just drew them and we kept drawing them and drawing them. So I showed that to my kids and then they created theirs. They go, oh, I want to create mine, my dream. And some of their dreams have kind of shifted around, but shifted from, you know, thing to thing. Like I want to be a pop star. Oh, and then I want to be a chef. Oh my gosh. And then I want to be a Broadway star. But Axel's have stayed really consistent since he was 7. Since he was 7, he drew it up, and we can go back there in the gym and I can show you that he drew up when he was 7. Okay. But here's what's cool. He's 14 now. So he's been following this dream for 7 years already, like training for the dream and rehearsing his future self. And the dream, it's never been done, right? So it's to play in the NFL and the NBA. So that's never been done.
Oh, I didn't know he wants to play in the NBA too.
Yeah. He wants to play both, and because no one's ever done it. There have been two people.
That's why you showed me a video before we started recording of your 14-year-old son throwing down with about 2 feet to clear over the rim.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Wow. So he's... And adults like our age will come to him all the time. They do for the last 7 years. And they go, Axel, which sport you like better? Which one are you going to choose? Mm-hmm. He will not say. He goes, I'm doing them both. I'm doing them both. And that's, if you look at the dream, if you look at his plan, that's exactly what it is. He drew it up, little stick figures of him playing both of those sports, and he will not back off.
Wow.
So Dawn and I, you know, when our kids, you know, declare their dreams, we take it seriously, right? So we go, okay, let's get the whole family involved in this dream. Mm-hmm. Let's go public with it. Let's make sure people know about it so we can get their energy to help us. And that's what we've done, you know. And we build boards of vision boards. We because there's certain,
that is so cool.
Yeah,
that is inspiring.
It's really cool. And you and a lot of their friends come over. You know, and they're teenagers now, right? Mm-hmm. So some of them laugh at their stuff. Then others go, you know what? I think you're going to do it.
Yeah.
I think you got this.
I love that. So you instilled in your kids at an early age an appreciation for having a long-term vision, long-term plan for their life.
Yeah.
And then you support that with vision boards, with goal setting, and with them not just having a dream, but creating a roadmap for that dream to happen.
Yeah. And we take little segments of time. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes we take a 66-day segment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll take, like Axel just went with Jeff Spencer. Mm-hmm. He went through like this 4-month.
Yeah. Jeff's been on my podcast before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, okay, great.
Champion's mindset.
Yeah. So that's what he's been working with Axel on because Axel's going to go into high school in the fall. I just thought Jeff was the perfect guy to prepare him for that big step.
Yeah. And you surround your children with amazing people too.
Yeah.
Because I noticed you know, you talked to another former podcast guest of mine, Terry Cochran, and someone else who's worked with your family. And I love that you bring in the outside experts too.
Yeah.
And I know that you know, sometimes people think, oh, whatever, silver spoon mentality, you can afford to bring in the experts. But I tell you what, like I personally learned just about everything that I've learned, not from mentors, not from experts, not from spending, $50,000 on online courses, which I know are often a good investment and come back to pay in dividends. But for me, like I have built most of my knowledge on like $5 to $10 books off Amazon,
yep.
Downloaded to my, like the experts exist out there, even if it's the stuff the experts wrote. So, and I think that introducing those into a child's life early on, my kids every day since they were 8 years old, dad gives them a book. By the end of the week, they return a 1-page book report on that book. The next week, I choose a book. And so every time I read a good book, I'm setting those books aside for my kids. And again, like it would cost me literally tens of thousands of dollars to have the expert who wrote that book move into my house and live with my kids for a week and teach them everything they know. Yeah. But I mean, if you're listening in, don't think that it's expensive to do this type of thing with your kid, but it's such great advice. Bowen, in wrapping up, I know if people wanted to like reach out to you and kind of learn how to move and how to present and how to speak and how to get this predatory type of confidence that you've alluded to, or maybe take one of your online courses, in which I know you do some of the same things. What's the best way for people to look you up?
Yeah. If they go to boeason.com, okay. So that's boeason.com. All my events that I do, Personal Story Power, mm-hmm. that's the one where we really get physical and we find everybody's signature piece, their story.
Cool.
And then physicalize it, attach it to some solar plexus mm-hmm. so that people trust. And, we've had huge success in that and it's been really, really, really amazing. So if you go to boeason.com, that's usually the best place.
Okay.
All the stuff we do.
Cool.
Is on there.
And other podcasts, other books that Bo and I talked about, everything that we discuss, I'll also link to if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/Bo Eason, BoEason. Let's go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/Bo Eason. Bo, I'm pretty stoked my audience gets to meet you and know who you are. You're a special guy and I love what you're doing. So keep it up, man. You're changing the world.
I will. Thanks, brother. Appreciate it.
All right, folks. I'm Ben Greenfield and Bo Eason. Signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. Have an amazing week.
Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at BenGreenfieldFitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.